Thanks a lot. Well, it's great to be here. So today I would like to talk about how tensor networks can be used to, detect topological phases or measure order parameters for topological phases, which gives you access to things like critical exponent information and so on. So this is joint work with a couple of people, most importantly Mohsen Iqbal, who's a postdoc with me, who has done all the numerics I'm going to show. So I also added in some more details about tensor networks. It won't be very detailed, but since I guess many people don't know much about tensor networks here, I'm going to give a bit of an overview what can be done with tensor networks. I guess we'll hear more in Frank's talk or informal presentation tomorrow. Okay, so to start, well, I guess I don't really have to introduce topological order here because that's one of the themes here of the program. But kind of the general theme for this talk here is that, well, what we have on the one hand is conventional order, which is described by Landau theory, basically by looking at local order parameters. So there's local observables, which give us a lot of information about the system, right? They allow us to identify in which phase we are, but they also give us access to different ground states, right? If we add a small term, a small perturbation, which couples to the order parameter, we select a specific ground state. So we can select ground states, we can label them by looking at the possible values the order parameter can take. So in some sense, it's a very powerful concept. So of course, we like topological order because it goes beyond Landau theory. It has a very rich phenomenology. But we're also lacking some kind of information, which we usually have if we have local order parameters. So something is also missing, because the point is, of course, that while topologically ordered phases don't order in a locally identifiable way, they order in some global pattern in the entanglement, right, in some global structure, which is not really accessible to local order parameters. And that's what I would like to discuss in this talk, or maybe in the second half of this talk. How can we come up with ways of devising order parameters, which, despite the fact that in principle there is no local order parameter, still can be measured by using this fact that tensor networks give us a way to access the entanglement in the system in some way which kind of reestablishes locality. And I will also connect these order parameters to some physical interpretation. I will discuss what is the physical meaning of these things. And kind of the key step is that we would like to reconcile a local description, which gives us access to order parameters usually, and which is also important, right, because the whole physics is governed by, well, Hamiltonians, which have some locality structure and so on. So locality is definitely an important concept. And on the other hand, what is important for this topological phase is the fact that the entanglement is some global entanglement, right? There are global correlations which govern the physics of the system. So we would like to find a way to reconcile these two concepts. And for that, the idea is to ask what is this the entanglement structure of these systems. So they have some complex global entanglement, but can it be arbitrarily complex, or is there still some structure? And the key insight is that there is some structure, and this kind of comes from the fact that the interactions have some notion of locality. They might be strictly local, they might be rapidly decaying. But there's some notion of locality, and say if you look at a quantum spin system on a lattice, which is what I will discuss in this talk, then if we have local interactions, what this means, say we have a Heisenberg antiferromagnetic interaction, the interaction wants to locally entangle two adjacent spins, right? The interaction doesn't care if distant spins are entangled, at least not directly. So the interaction kind of will push the system towards entangling degrees of freedom locally. And if we get more complex entanglement, that's kind of a higher order effect. So it is indeed plausible to expect that basically only close by degrees of freedom become entangled, which is kind of shown in this cartoon picture. So if we ask, if we take a certain region, we would argue that only degrees of freedom close to the boundary are entangled to degrees of freedom outside, which brings us to what is known as the area law for entanglement of ground states, also low energy states, which states that when we cut a region in a ground state, say, of a quantum system, the entanglement scales like the boundary of that region and not like the volume of that region. And kind of the important point to see, say, from a quantum information perspective, is that this is a very, very special property. Because if you would take some random quantum state in the full Hilbert space, this would have a volume law scaling, right? Like random states basically always have a volume law scaling with a very, very small correction. So an area law scaling is extremely special. So actually, these complex entangled states are still extremely special in the way in which they are entangled. Namely, they have much less entanglement than a general state would have. Okay. So now what we would like to do is we would take this information that the entanglement should be built up locally and make some ansatz out of that, some variational class of wave functions which captures that structure. And well, there's different ways to introduce them. I will show both. So one way of thinking of that is to say we have these particles, say on a one-dimensional chain to start with, and we think of them as being built from subparticles, from auxiliary particles. And then we have to glue these auxiliary particles together, so we will apply some map P, which, say, projects them to a certain subspace. I will give an example in a second. And finally, what we do is that we take these guys here, these virtual auxiliary particles, and we put them in an entangled state. So, for instance, in this maximally entangled state here. So what we have been doing is we have been describing a one-dimensional chain by starting from some local entanglement between adjacent sites, and then applying some map which basically restricts ourselves to some physical subspace, so projects onto a physical subspace. So the idea is if we work like that, we really start building up the entanglement locally. And this map here can't really increase the entanglement if the state is already maximally entangled. Like the Schmidt rank, in the, so if you take this cut, there's a summation index running over this cut from 1 to d. And applying local maps will not increase the summation index, right? So the amount of correlation, the amount of entanglement, is limited by this number d. This kind of controls how much correlation such a state can have. So that's one way of looking at that. There's another formulation, which is the one I will use mostly in this talk, which is a so-called tensor network formulation. And the idea is that if I have such a map P here, which acts on two of these auxiliary virtual degrees of freedom and produces a physical degree of freedom, it's a linear map. So I can think of this as saying a state alpha here and a state beta here is mapped to a state I with some amplitude given by the entries in this tensor, AI alpha beta. And if I apply this to a maximally entangled state, what this entangled state does, well, it's like a delta function, right? It enforces this particle and that particle to be in the same state. So effectively, this means if I have all these maps described by some tensor A, what the entangled state will do is it will force these two indices to be equal, which we graphically depict by this connected line. So what this connected line really means is that we identify the second index beta of this guy with the first index here of the second tensor, and we sum over that. So if we do this on the whole chain, so basically what you see is that you multiply these matrices. If you think of AI as a matrix with matrix indices alpha and beta, what this is doing, it's really multiplying these two matrices. And if you keep going like that, we keep multiplying these matrices. Maybe I should have put a formula. Is that some chirp? Okay. Which board is worse?
This one is worse.
This one is.
Depends on what you see.
Well, exactly. But maybe one is worse than the other. So if we take this whole chain here, right? Each of these things will basically correspond to a multiplication, right? So I think of this as a matrix in alpha and beta, right? This would be a matrix. And then doing this sum basically means that I, well, multiply two adjacent matrices, AI1 and AI2. And then I keep going like that, right? So I would multiply another matrix, which depends on the value of the third spin, and so on. And if I say have periodic boundary condition, I would finally get a trace because the very first index is identified with the very last index. And this would be a coefficient, which would be exactly the amplitude of the basis state I1 to IN. And well, this is exactly a product of matrices, which is why this state is called a matrix product state. I think there should have been this formula on the slide, but I guess when I assembled the slides, somehow the formula got lost. Right, so let me give you an example, which I guess some of you might know. So that's the AKLT state. I guess probably most of you are familiar with it or have seen it. So the idea in that case is that what we take as a maximally, so we take as auxiliary particles spin 1/2 particles, and we put them in an entangled state, which is a singlet state, so which I write as 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And then what we have is we have two spin 1/2 particles, so they can decompose in a spin 0 and a spin 1 space. And this map P in this case will project onto the spin 1 space. it's an isometry, right? So it maps into the spin 1 space. So what we get is a spin 1 chain. And the point is this chain is built from rotationally invariant objects, right? The singlets are rotationally invariant. And the map P commutes with the rotation, with the spin rotation. So what we get is we get a rotationally invariant state in this case. And one important message, which goes beyond the specific model, is that the symmetry has been encoded locally, right? I built the thing from local building blocks. Each of the building blocks is symmetric, so I do get something which is finely symmetric. So symmetries in this picture can be encoded locally. What we also see is that if we put an edge in the system, at the edge we will have spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. We have this integer spin chain, which at the edge has a half integer degrees of freedom, which is some, well, topological effect in the end, right? It's it's one signature of the fact that the system has symmetry protected topological order. This again becomes very clear in this picture, right? Looking at this picture, we see that the edge will have the spin 1/2 degrees of freedom sitting there. And so if we look further into it, we look at two adjacent sites. Well, two adjacent sites are two spin 1 particles, which together can have spin 0 or 1 or 2. But now if we look at this level here, where we have four spin 1/2 particles, that also adds up to these three possibilities. But in fact, we know this guy in the middle is a singlet. So we know that actually this guy here has spin 0. So we start from two spin 1/2 and one spin 0 state. So we can actually only get spin 0 or 1. We cannot get the spin 2 state. And this means that we can write a Hamiltonian, which gives a higher energy to spin 2. And then this will be a ground state of that Hamiltonian. So we can build a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of projections onto spin 2 of two adjacent sites, which can be written in this form, right? That's the XFT Hamiltonian. And it turns out one can prove that, well, it's easy to see that this will be a ground state, but it turns out it's a unique ground state, and the system has a gap above that, which was the main motivation of the AKLT work, to actually prove that a system of that kind, similar to a Haldane chain, does have a gap. So all of these things are not specific to this one model here. So for instance, the fact that there is such a Hamiltonian just comes from counting degrees of freedom. I was talking about spin, but I could have just counted degrees of freedom, right? The two spin ones have 9 degrees of freedom in total. But I start from a space which has only 2 × 2, 4 degrees of freedom, right? So there will be states missing. It happens that this is a 5-dimensional spin 2 space, but it's a general argument, right? It would have always happened without thinking about spins, just by counting degrees of freedom, so we can always construct these kind of Hamiltonians. Questions?
Can you repeat why the bond must be a singlet?
Well, we start like that, right? The idea is we construct a state where we put the bond in a singlet state.
Okay.
That's just the rule how we construct it, right? We could build some different states starting from something else. But as long as we know that this is a well-defined unique state, there's only four possibilities from which we could start, right? Because that's the only boundary conditions we have. So in that sense, it's not specific to this model. What's specific to this model is, of course, that you get this nice SU2 invariant Hamiltonian.
No, you said that you see that it's a unique ground state.
Well, you can prove it. I'm not sure you can see it just like that. I hope I didn't say that.
Can you say you can prove it? Like, how do you prove it? Is it like a simple proof? Or?
Well, the uniqueness is okay. That's not so hard. I mean, the gap is harder. The uniqueness is okay.
But I mean,
I can explain you later. I'm not sure if my question.
It has nothing to do with tensor networks, right? This is a general, like AKLT did themselves, right?
Sure. I mean, it's the same formalism, like tensor networks, right? Of course, we wouldn't call it tensor network, but it's the same idea. Yeah?
So maybe not a very good question. So there seems to be some similarity between this MPS state with some pattern construction, exotic phases. So to what extent the magic products that can be understood from some kind of pattern construction?
I don't know enough about patterns to really competently answer that, but I don't think it's the same.
No, it's not the same, I'm just asking.
That's a good question. I mean, we can talk about that later, but I don't know enough about patterns to give a good answer on that, I think. Okay. Okay, so focus in this talk will be in two dimensions. So we can do the same kind of construction in two dimensions. So we could start from entangled states and apply maps. Or we could start from, we could look at this as a tensor with five indices, which we put on a two-dimensional grid. And again, we contract the indices, right? And again, contracting these indices, because it's summation builds up correlations, right? Summation is the same as correlation, because it's not a product anymore. We can do this on any lattice, right? I usually draw square lattices, because why not? They're also easier to draw, obviously. But you can easily see that you can do this on any kind of lattice or graph you want. In this talk, I will mostly think about infinite systems, but you can also put these systems on a torus or put some specific boundary conditions. And you, of course, have to say how you choose a boundary tensors. You might choose three or two index tensors on the boundary, right? Like cutting off legs. Or you might attach some vector. You might project this onto a specific basis state here, something like that. You can choose these tensors all different, or you can choose them all equal, depending what you want to describe. So there's lots of freedom in that. But the main point is that always that the correlations are being built up locally. So they have the kind of right correlation structure for systems with an area law. So let me just state some results about tensor network states. If you want to know more, feel free to ask. So one observation, it's kind of a trivial observation, but also an important observation, is that they include mean field. In the sense that if I choose this dimension here, right, this dimension is a physical system. That's basically fixed by the system I'm looking at. But I can play with this dimension, this auxiliary dimension, I can increase. If I increase it, I get more and more states, right? But in particular, I can choose it to be equal to one, a one-dimensional space, which means there is no index, basically, right? Then this is just a vector, because these are one-dimensional. If it's just a vector, it's a product state, right? So it's a mean field ansatz, basically. So mean field is included. That's kind of good, because mean field is not so bad, after all. But the other thing is, as soon as we increase D, we get correlations. Now, you could say maybe that's a perturbation around mean field, so it's maybe not so interesting, but that's not true, because even with D equal 2, we can already exactly describe topological models like the Torrey-Code model. And it turns out that actually all the quantum double models and all string net models have exact representations in terms of tensor networks.
What's the finite value of D?
Sorry?
What's the finite value of the internal dimension?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, with a finite?
It's a finite bond then.
Yes. Yes.
So I have a question. So if it includes mean field, can you also make it dynamical? Can you also include dynamical mean field? So would there be a way to relate dynamical mean field?
That's a good question.
Maybe we can talk later.
Maybe we can talk later, indeed. Again, I'm not enough of an expert on DMFT to.
Do I understand correctly? These are kind of proof that there is such a proof of existence.
No. We can write them down.
Well, you don't know what to write down, right? So you have a Hamiltonian.
By representation, I mean ground state, right? First of all, to start with. So we're talking about low energy states. In particular, ground states to start with, right? Once you have a ground state, you can start building excitations on top of it. But it's about low energy physics, because at high energies, the area law will not hold, right? You can have many more correlations. At some point, you explore the whole Hilbert space, so there's no way you can describe.
So you're saying those ground states can be represented
exactly.
As a matrix product state.
But you can also construct one of these parent Hamiltonians. If you remember from the AKLT, there was this argument that you look at the states you can get in a certain region, like on two sides, and you see you can't get all states. The same holds in two dimensions, right? I can basically say, well, let me look at the 2x2 block and ask how many states can I get. Then you have to count the degrees of freedom you can put at the boundary. This will tell you the dimension of the space you can get. Then you look at the physical space. If the physical space is larger than the number of states you can get, then you can write on a Hamiltonian, which kind of penalizes all states you cannot get. And this will always happen if you block a bigger region, right? Because the number of degrees of freedom in the volume will grow exponentially with volume, and the number of degrees of freedom at the boundary will grow exponentially with the boundary. Right? So very soon, if you block it, at some point, you will reach the case where the physical space is bigger than the boundary space. And then these Hamiltonians, they're not exactly one-to-one identical to the Torrey-Code Hamiltonian. But, I mean, they're not uniquely defined either, right? You just want to give a higher energy to the states you cannot get. But what energy you give, you can play with.
One more question, it's more qualitative in nature. So the reason MPS works so well in one dimension, mm-hmm.
is because the area law in this case is basically scales like a constant for mm-hmm. map system, which means you typically need a constant value of the bond dimension, something finite, mm-hmm. in order to well represent even a long Now, in two dimensions, the area would go as the mm-hmm. as the linear size of the system, which means, in principle, you would need, as you go to thermodynamic limit, your bond dimension would have to scale with L, with the system size.
No.
So now, so the question now
why?
Is...
Why? I don't see the argument, I think. I mean the point is, if I cut any region here, say I cut this region, right? I know that the entanglement will scale like the length of the boundary of that region. But then you can ask how much correlations do I have between that region and the rest? And well, I mean, each of these bonds which I contract gives a summation index, so it gives correlations. So the number of bonds which I cut is also proportional to the length of the boundary, right? So the amount of correlations, the amount of entanglement I get, potentially will exactly have that area loss scaling. I mean, a cartoon picture you can always think of is that you think of these entangled states here, and you don't put any map P, right? So it's just a product state, but a kind of non-trivial product state in the sense that you put entangled pairs between adjacent sites. Like in 1D, this would be like an RG fixed point of the Haldane chain or so, or of the AKLT model. And then you see that indeed you have entanglement exactly between adjacent degrees of freedom and nothing else. So you always have exactly that area loss scaling.
My question was really about your statement about the topological phases such as Kitaev combinatorial mm-hmm. code. So your statement is that with a finite bond dimension, you could encode the long-range entanglement in the Kitaev model exactly.
Mm-hmm. For the toric code, it's bond dimension 2, indeed.
And that's a statement about constructing the ground state of the toric code?
Yes. It's actually not so hard to see, maybe qualitatively, if you have this loop picture in mind of the toric code ground state, like sum over all loops. What you want to correlate between one region and the rest is where the loops are going, right? So just at every point, basically, you need to keep track if there's a loop or not. So, and that's exactly what this index will do, right? This index will have two values, 0 or 1, and 0 says no loop and 1 says loop. And this tensor has to take care that you only have closed loops. And then, of course, you have to think a bit to see that you get all loop configurations, but the idea is that that's all the information you have to correlate in the toric code to get the global entanglement pattern. It's like whenever you cut somewhere, you need to know if there's a loop crossing or not at a certain position.
Question. So this construction, can it be kind of generalized, not necessarily to real space? So as far as I understand, so these objects are basically, you know, lattice size or something mm-hmm. like that, right? So say I do some Fourier transform to momentum space, and can it be presented, let's say, in momentum space lattice as opposed to real space lattice? Let's say if I want to describe some Gaussian.
How do you want to Fourier transform? It's a many interacting many body picture, right? So, so I guess we first would have to.
So I'm just saying. So basically, you're just selecting a class of variational states you work with because they give you what you want, which is this area law, mm-hmm. which I think would limit you to gapped states of certain classes.
Well, in the same sense as the MRG in 1D limits you to gapped systems, but of course the thing is that even for gapless systems the correction to the area law is not so big, it's a log divergence, right?
Okay, anyway,
so numerically you don't get things exactly, but you can get approximately.
So basically,
okay, I'm not sure what Fourier is, it's many body, right? So it's not clear if you can do a single particle picture Fourier transform in an easy way in that representation.
No, but that's momentum space schema G, right? So
yeah.
It only becomes very non-local.
Right. You can do it,
but you're just writing variational states. You can write whatever you want, right?
So. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. In principle, yes. Obviously, if there's a way to transform it, if you still can do things efficiently, I mean, of course, you want to work with the variational states, right? Otherwise, so well, I guess you want to do computations or you want to prove things or something. But in principle, there's no reason why you shouldn't write this in this space.
I guess there's no reason to expect an area law in momentum space.
Exactly. Well. Again, in the single particle picture, it would factorize, but it's a many body picture. So, well, okay, maybe we continue. Okay, so extra ground states we have. We can do the same kind of things also, for instance, for fermionic systems or continuum theories and so on. So maybe just to give a short intuition why this is actually a good ansatz beyond just this area law motivation, this really comes from saying if I want to describe a low energy state, basically I can take e to the minus beta h. And if there's a gap, I don't have to choose a particularly large beta to get a good approximation of the ground state if I apply this to some initial state, which is a product state. And then I can trotterize this. And then in the Trapper expansion, I get these two-body terms, right, which push you closer to the ground state. And every two-body term I can, of course, decompose by putting a summation index here, right? It's just writing an operator as sum over AI tensor BI. And once I have this decomposition, then I can look at this Trapper expansion and just write it like that, right? Even linked terms, odd linked terms, and so on. And then each of these columns, if I block it, is just one tensor. Now, this index, of course, potentially will be very big. But intuitively, each of these steps is only very weakly correlated if epsilon is small, right? Because this is identity plus something very small. So there should be a way to compress it, and one can indeed show that one can compress these things. I mean, that's a bit formalizing the intuition that if you want to be in a ground state, the Hamiltonian force is a local degrees of freedom to be correlated, right? And everything else is a higher order effect. So maybe that's an additional motivation why this is a good answer. And one can indeed prove approximation results along these lines, right? Showing that you can efficiently approximate low energy states with this type of ansatz. One can efficiently evaluate these things numerically. Should I say something about that? Because at some point I might be running short with the order parameters.
That's the key point, isn't it?
Well, depends. Of course, maybe some people are more happy to learn something about the tensor networks.
My suggestion would be, sorry, I'll take prerogatives as organizers. So we want to have time for discussion for sure in the end. Mm-hmm. But we want to also hear the punchline. So what we would do always is to defer that to... you would save that slide and show it in the end of the
conversation. Let me save the numeric slide and the physical symmetry slide and just get to topological order. But the point is one can efficiently do numerics with these things. Let me also skip this one, maybe. So what I would like to talk about are systems with topological order in this formalism. And the key point is that if you describe systems with topological order, what you find is that these systems, the tensors you use for that description, have a symmetry on the entanglement degrees of freedom, or if you wish, a constraint on the entanglement degrees of freedom. Namely, they're invariant under, for instance, some group action. So the easiest case would be toric code, in which case a group action would be Z2. So in the toric code phase, you would have a Z2 symmetry action there. So we can take this equation and put these... So this is really a matrix, right, which I contract. That's the same type of tensor language, right? I have an index, and I multiply this index with a matrix. So there's another index sticking out here, if you wish. So I can take two of these U's and put them to the other side of the equation, and that's the form of the equation we're actually thinking of usually. Because what it means is if I think of these U's as being arranged along a line, I can pull this line through the tensor, right? Whether I have this line passing on the top or at the bottom of the tensor doesn't matter. It's the same object, right? It's mathematically the same thing. Now, this can be generalized to correlated actions here using either so-called matrix product operators or Hopf algebras, and then you can indeed describe all string net models in that formalism. But I won't talk about that. I will stick with this product picture. It's somewhat easier. Now, once you have this picture in mind, it's not so hard to see what this has to do with topological order, at least on a qualitative, somewhat hand-wavy picture. Because what this means, as I said, is if you arrange these group actions, UG, I just write a G here, along some string, the string can be moved at will. In the set, moved at will just means I can put it wherever I want. I describe the same object mathematically, right? There's no difference. There's no meaning in saying that the string runs along a specific line. Which indeed means that if I want to check locally if there's a string, say I have one of these parent Hamiltonians, the parent Hamiltonian will not be able to see this line, right? Because if I look here, of course, now I would say the line is running through that thing. It's a different tensor network. But it's actually not true, right? Because it's the same as this description. Now the line has been moved away. So the string cannot be seen locally. And then one can do things like putting a system on a torus and have these strings run in horizontal and vertical direction in our system. And this way we can just parameterize a set of states. And it turns out that these states are actually distinct. So one can parameterize a ground state manifold, for instance. And again, because these strings can be moved at will, I mean, there's some subtleties for non-abelian cases and so on, but just think of Z2, right? These things can be moved at will, so they cannot be seen locally. So we have a degenerate ground space or a degenerate set of states, which, however, are distinct. So that's one of the signatures of topological order. The other one are anionic excitations. So what we can also do is we can put these strings but have them terminate somewhere. Then again, the string can be moved, but the endpoints cannot be moved, right? The endpoints cannot be moved because there's an odd number of group elements adjacent to this plaquette. But the fact that we can conjugate our tensor with the group action we'll change this by an even number, right? So this number will always stay odd. So this endpoint under Plaquette is special. So what this means is that potentially, or generically, we expect a Hamiltonian to, well, give a higher energy there. So these would be excitations, but point-like excitations. The other thing we can do is we can put excitations on the links. We can put objects on the links which anti-commute with these strings. So basically things which transform like irreducible representations of that symmetry group action. And then these things also form excitations. And the point is, for instance, think of the string as Pauli X, right, in the Z2 case. And of this thing as a Pauli Z. And now think, imagine you do a braiding experiment. Don't worry how you move them. Just think, imagine you could move them. You move these particles in a loop. And then you're left with a loop of X's, right? And the thing is, this loop can be deformed. So if there wouldn't be a Z in the middle, you could just shrink it to a point and it would go away. But now there's a Z, so at some point you have to anti-commute it. So you get a minus sign. And that's exactly kind of the source of the minus sign in the Torrey code.
Chi here, I didn't get it. You said it was an irreducible representation.
Chi, is it written somewhere?
Chi.
Exactly. The idea is that chi is something which has a non-trivial commutation relation with the group action, right? So an object which transforms like an irreducible representation. It could be a mix of several irreps, but then it's not a unique particle. It's a mix of different particle types.
So for example, along the line, you represented this at these UGs, which were... Mm-hmm. Group operations, I guess. So what's chi? How do you represent this one?
Okay, I mean, if the group action is say sigma x, right? The group is Z2, so you act with sigma x. It would be a sigma z, right? Which anti-commutes with sigma x.
Yes. So it would be, I guess, an operator that would create two monopoles on adjacent squares.
Second.
Correct.
Sorry.
Would that be, so if I act with sigma x on a Torrey code, that would generically flip the size of the two plaquettes. So you could think of them as creating two magnetic monopoles.
Yes.
So can I think of chi as an operator that creates a pair?
It's not acting on the physical system, right? So I'm kind of just asking how can I describe anions. I'm not asking how can I create them. That can be more subtle. So in some sense, of course, if you think of this as an RG fixed point wave function, say Torrey code, we know exactly how to create anionic excitations. But let's say you move away from the RG fixed point, you get a finite correlation length, then creating an anion is actually a subtle thing, right? Because you would have to quasi-adiabatically evolve your operator. It kind of gets fattened over something on the range of the correlation length. So it's pretty messy, right? Whereas here, describing the topological excitations is still very simple, right? Because we do it on the entanglement degrees of freedom. So in some sense, what this means is that anions are kind of a twist in the entanglement in the system, like a branch cut or whatever in the entanglement. And that's what these objects are doing. So it's a very convenient way to describe states with anions. Now, creating them is probably still a mess by acting with a physical operator in a general case because, well, it can't get easier, right? It's still the same Hamiltonian and the same eigenstate you want to create. But just mathematically describing these states, at least the topological content of that state, is much easier. Right. In some sense, physically, you don't even know how to create an eigenstate. If I give you some Hamiltonian, I take the Torrey code, I rotate it randomly, I don't tell you how I rotated it. It's kind of hard, potentially hard to figure out what you even have to do, even in the Torrey code. Right? Whereas here, it's clear because it's kind of twisting these symmetries. Okay.
Norman, there is a question here.
Oh, sorry.
Just a small one. Just, can I think of this symmetry of the tensor as a representation of, let's say, the gauge symmetry in some gauge Z2? For example, Z2 gauge theory.
It's closely linked. I mean, this looks, of course, very much like what you get in gauge theories if you have magnetic or electric.
And is it like that, if my topological order corresponds to specific gauge theory, then the group will be the same as the first?
I mean, this is not a gauge theory, right? We have to be careful in several ways, right? But the structure is very similar, I guess. Right, so this whole thing is on the one hand nice because it gives you some analytic understanding how these excitations look like. But also, of course, it's very nice numerically because you can really build these excitations. So for instance, you can construct excitations in a certain topological sector and study their properties, maybe their dynamics and so on, depending on your method. And of course, to get an exact eigenstate, you probably would have to dress the endpoint, right? This only gives you the topological sector correctly. But that one you already have, and then you could use whatever method you would use to also construct trivial excitations if you want eigenstates, for instance. Okay, so now I get to the actual content of my talk. So the idea is that we would like to use these things to measure some order parameters. So my pictures change a bit, but it's the same pictures, right? The tensors are the red dots now, and it's just the same as before. So the idea is that, well, this now, the blue lines denote these strings of symmetry group actions, right? Of this entanglement symmetry group actions. So that's the magnetic strings. And at the end, we can put objects on a link which transform like irreducible representations, which are the electric excitations. And we can combine them, obviously. So we get some dionic excitations, right? That's the most general excitation we can get. It's a combination of electric and magnetic excitation. And in principle, we can dress these excitations. So for instance, here, we should actually allow to have some trivially transforming tensor, but different from the original tensor, ground state tensor, to dress the endpoint. We should also allow for it here, but of course, the irreducible representation is not unique, right? This actually already allows to dress the endpoint. So maybe there we can do without. In this case, certainly, we should allow for a way to dress the endpoint. But this will not change the topological nature, right? So in that sense, that's not crucial. So now what we want to do is we want to study what these objects do. So we want to compute expectation values. So all these pictures are expectation values. I have one cat tensor network and one bra tensor network. And I compute an expectation value. So one thing I could do is I could put a pair of anions. So I just draw the general picture. But of course, you could choose the irrep trivial or the group trivial. Then you get the special cases, right? Of only electric or only magnetic. So I can ask what's the overlap of a state with a pair of anions with the ground state. That's what this picture denotes, right? It's only in the cat layer I put a pair. Then I can ask what happens when I separate them. So now if I'm in a topological phase, what do I expect? Well, if the anions are very close by, this is basically a topologically trivial object. So from a topological point of view, there's no obstruction that this would be non-zero, so we expect this to be non-zero, presumably. Now I start separating them. If they're very separated, one anion doesn't see the other one. So locally, the thing is in a different topological sector. Let's take the other one to infinity. So these should be orthogonal, right? Because they're different topological sectors. We should get zero. So we expect that it decays exponentially in a gap system. So that's really a symbolic notation, right? Don't ask me what it means. It's symbolic for putting one anion here and putting one here and measuring the correlator. We expect this to decay exponentially, and this defines a length scale, right? So this will give us a length scale, which we could think of as a mass gap, or the inverse of the mass gap of the anion, right? Now, it could happen, maybe, that we drive the system into a phase transition, and then maybe what happens is that this correlation function doesn't go to zero, right? This would basically happen when the anion has condensed into the ground state, that one anion or no anion is kind of the same state locally. So this thing wouldn't go to zero, it would go to a constant. So if it goes to a constant, this can be used to define an order parameter, basically some kind of condensate fraction, if you wish. So it would be an order parameter corresponding to the condensation of an anion. Now, the other thing we can ask is what is a normalization of a state with a pair of anions? That's the same anion in the two layers. Now, in this case, we would expect if these anions are well-defined, deconfined objects, then this correlation, this normalization shouldn't depend on the separation of the anions, right? It should be a nice object. So we expect that such a normalization should actually go to a constant. And this, again, defines an order parameter, now in the topological phase, right? Before we had an order parameter in the condensed phase, where n was condensed, which is something like a deconfinement or deconfined fraction, something corresponding to deconfinement. I'm not sure if that's a good name, but I think it's reasonable to.
So how is this defining? I thought you defined it such a way that it's actually normalized, but I guess.
That's a tricky point. I mean, one can have lengthy discussions about this question, but kind of what I'm asking, it's a relative normalization, right? It's a normalization of that thing divided by the normalization of the bare ground state, right? So the question is kind of, I put a pair of anions and I ask, well, how does this affect the normalization? And then you can ask, how is the normalization affected if I separate them? The point is, if this normalization goes to zero, then you hand-wavingly, you expect the state to be extremely fragile to small perturbations, right? Because it has such a small norm, so if you perturb it in a way which couples it to anything which has a norm which doesn't go to zero with a separation, that contribution will go away, which kind of means that the state with very much separated anions would be extremely fragile if this norm goes to zero, which kind of means that it's not physical. It's a bit hand-wavy. I agree it's not the standard way you would look at confinement, but I think in this variational way it makes a lot of sense to think about it like that.
Now, but could you relate the notion of deconfinement to another way how people formulate it, which is to say that the tension of the string has to vanish? Or another way to say it is that as you separate the anion arbitrarily far away, the energy of the string remains constant.
Mm-hmm. I think one can link it like that, but of course the thing is here, there's no energy here, there's not even a Hamiltonian. It's really a property of a wave function in some sense.
But don't you start
and I think it's completely fine to think of that as a property of a wave function, but I'm not sure everyone shares this opinion. I mean, certainly topological order, in my opinion, is a property of a state, in the sense that it tells you that this state supports excitations with exotic statistics. Now, whether the confined phase is a property of the state, that's a different question. But I think philosophically, I think it makes complete sense to not think about Hamiltonians in particular when you talk about topological order. Because you can define what topological order is by looking at a state.
Yeah, I mean, this is maybe a little bit of a detailed question, but I would see these wave functions as sort of variational wave functions for mm-hmm. localized anion, right? Just sort of creating it in some specific place. And, you know, sort of in a generic system, anions probably propagate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know their propagation can be a little bit non-trivial. They can, you know, transform in some projective way under mm-hmm. under translations, for example, see some effective mm-hmm. flux. That if you were to try to build up plane wave-like states of the anions, does it know about this?
Well, I guess you would have to build your plane wave state in a way that it transforms non-trivially. So you have to think about how you do that, right? But I don't think there's
some
structure
other
to that.
Constraints. You know, there are constraints related to Liebscholz-Mattis.
Uh-huh. Well, this would tell you that you shouldn't be able to construct such an excitation if there's a constraint, right?
Yeah, I'm asking, does that show up in some natural way?
Yeah, well, Liebscholz-Mattis type statements for sure. This was one of the slides I skipped, which was saying that if you try to encode a spin 1/2 system, you actually naturally see that there is a Liebscholz-Mattis type obstruction to encoding that symmetry. Maybe I can show it later or so. But I mean, these things show up in a fairly natural way. We don't fully understand it, but we certainly understand things like Liebscholz-Mattis in this picture. It's not the full Liebscholz-Mattis theorem, but you see the same property, right? That you cannot have trivial order if you have SU2 symmetry. It's actually very naturally pushed to something which in a gap case should be a Z2 Torricot type order. But there could be other possibilities. So the question is like, what's the most general way to say encode SU2, which is indeed not fully settled. Okay, I guess I should be going on.
Question.
Yes.
So it seems that you kind of need to know what the anionic excitations are before constructing this, right? So if you're handed some generic system of fermions or spins with some Hamiltonian.
I think indeed in the simulation you need a guess what your I mean, I will show results later, right? And the thing is, of course, you need to encode the symmetry, right? So these objects only make sense if you know what symmetry operation you have to put here and what the IREPs are, the endpoints, and so on, right? You don't have to construct perfect eigenstates for this whole order parameter business, but that's always true for order parameters, right? You only need to know the symmetry to define an order parameter. I mean, everything else you can add in, but say von Ising model, right? I mean, all you need to know is a Z2 symmetry. You take anything which anticommutes with the symmetry, it's a good order parameter. Maybe not the most elegant one, because you want to have it aligned along the magnetization direction. But if it's in a different direction, also works. But you need to know the symmetry, so to say, or you need to have a guess what the phase could be. But I think that's basically true for every method, right? You need some guess what you're looking for. I think otherwise it's indeed difficult. Right, so again, what we would get in one phase would be a deconfined fraction, and again, if there's a transition into a confined phase, we would expect this normalization to go down exponentially. We can expect a length scale, right? So we can use this to study phase transition. So basically, if we have a transition from a phase to a less complex phase where we have condensed some anions, we can, for the condensed anions, first we have anion masses or correlation lengths on one side, and after the condensation we get order parameters for condensation, condensate fractions for those anions. And for the anions which become confined in the transition, we first have an order parameter which measures the deconfinement. And after the transition, that will go to zero in the transition, and after the transition we will get some length scales. Now, let me skip the next two slides and show you some numerical results, because I guess I should finish soonish, or what's the time scale?
So we have the room reserved until 12:30, but the idea is to have...
Well, I don't think I should talk until 12:30.
No, definitely not. The idea is that, well, I'm making adjustment for the fact that there has been a lot of questions, which is good. But so if you could wrap up in the next 10, 15 minutes, and then we can continue the discussion, that would be great.
Okay, you know, I think that should work out fine. Okay. So if you want to compute these kind of objects, right, what do we have to do? Basically, we have to look at objects of this kind, where we have one pair of anions in one layer, maybe a different pair of anions in the other layer, like no anion, or the same anion. But we could take different, basically, overlaps of different sectors. And then we want to study what happens as we separate that. And the way this works numerically is that we would, or also formally, analytically, is that we would go from left to right and cut this into slices. So each slice is an object like that. It's a transfer operator. And then we compute the fixed point of that transfer operator numerically. It's like the leading eigenvector. So if you would think of that as something like a Hamiltonian, this would be the ground state, so to say. It's kind of an analogy. And then we want to measure this kind of operator in that fixed point. So this fixed point in a gapped system, we would assume to be well approximated by a matrix product state. So it should be the same as a ground state of a local Hamiltonian regarding its correlations or entanglement structure. It just doesn't live in a physical space. It lives in the entanglement space. So it really relates more to the entanglement spectrum. So we have this fixed point, and then in this fixed point, we need to measure this expectation value of this pair of string operators. So what we're measuring is really we have a state, and we measure a string of symmetry actions with endpoints which are irreducible representations. So what we're really measuring is a string order parameter, right? This transfer matrix here has exactly those symmetries, right? Because it's built from tensors which have those symmetries. These were the symmetries we started from. So it's kind of very resembled of having a local Hamiltonian with certain symmetries, looking at the ground state and measuring string order parameters in that ground state. So we know what order parameters and string order parameters do. They detect symmetry breaking or symmetry protected phases. So in some sense, we're really measuring something. So the possible outcomes we can get, the possible behaviors, should be in one-to-one correspondence to the potential phases we can have under the given symmetry. So one can use this for some kind of I should have shown this right away, right? We have the local symmetry here. Then we have this two-layer object, which has a double symmetry. So it's really a G cos G symmetry. It's like two copies of that group. And then we're measuring string order parameters. And one can really use this to classify the possible behaviors you can see. And one can show, certainly in the abelian case, that this is really in one-to-one correspondence to all possible phases you can get starting from a Zn quantum double by condensation confinement and get the whole behavior. And it's really very closely related to the classification of one-dimensional phases under symmetries. So that's a classification of one-dimensional phases under symmetries. There's symmetry breaking. The unbroken symmetry can have symmetry protected order, which is classified by the second group cohomology. But then there's an extra property, namely that this object has some ket and bar structure, which is reflected in the fact that the fixed point has to be a positive operator. It's not a state. It's an operator, right? It's not a pure state. This gives extra constraints. I don't want to discuss them, but they're actually important. They rule out certain phases and certain symmetry breaking patterns. But overall, one gets exactly the classification one knows. So one can study this numerically. So one thing we did was to set up a family of wave functions with some parameters, so no Hamiltonian. We just set up a family of wave functions where we play with parameters, starting from a Z4 quantum double and then playing with three parameters, right? That's a cut through the three-dimensional phase diagram, which has a Z4 quantum double phase. That's kind of the mother phase.
So, what are the other parameters? Are the Cs?
Say again?
What are the three Xs?
Okay, so we have a three-parameter family of states, which means we make a local tensor which has three parameters we can tune, and that's a three axis.
Are you going to tell us what the three parameters mean physically or how they're related to the structure of the tensor? Or you just say, well, it's some cos theta, sine theta.
We just made them up. Well, the idea was, of course, to drive it into different phases. So the idea is we start from the most complex phase, and then there's one parameter which drives a condensation to a topic code phase. There's another one which also drives a condensation to a code phase, but condensing a different particle. And there's a third one which drives a condensation into a double semion phase.
What's the d in one dimension? Just
4. It's really a family of wave functions. I will show results later obtained variationally, that's kind of the first step to benchmark things, right? And then it's obviously more complex if you start from a Hamiltonian and first have to optimize your wave function. So then what you can do is you can indeed study these transitions. So that's a transition along this line going from the Z4 double to the Torrey code, condensing, a flux particle. So what you can indeed see, that's the interpolation, that's the order parameters, that's correlation length. So what you can see, for instance, there's one anion which becomes condensed. So you start in the Z4 phase. It's not condensed, right? And suddenly, the order parameter for condensation sets in. So there's a certain condensate fraction. Opposite for the length scale, there's a mass gap. The mass goes to zero. The correlation length diverges. And conversely, there's a particle which becomes confined. This is deconfined before the phase transition. So there's an order parameter measuring the deconfinement. And then there's a length scale for the confinement on the other side. And well, this specific line, because it's an exact family of wave function, actually maps to the 2+0 dimensional Ising model. So we can extract various critical exponents, which exactly match the critical exponents of the 2+1 Ising model, 2+0 Ising model. So this shows that the method really works. It's applicable.
And when you say it's maps to the Torrey code, isn't Torrey code deconfined?
Sorry, Torrey code? No. Did I? Well, this is a Torrey code phase, right? But we start from a Z4 phase. The Z4 phase has 16 anions, right? And then you condense certain anions, like you condense one anion, and then you get a Torrey code phase.
So when you say there's a confinement length, that's with respect to the anions that are not part of the Torrey code.
Exactly. So that's kind of the table of anions. There's four fluxes and four charges. And this guy here gets condensed with that one. That's what the order parameter measures, the overlap. And then these pairs get identified through the condensation, right? That's a corollary of condensation, that other pairs become indistinguishable. And these kind of I charges become confined because of a non-trivial braiding with this particle, because it's I squared, the statistics. Right? The statistics is always alpha to the G. So half of them become, so you have 16, half becomes confined. The other half becomes pairwise identified, so you're left with four. I mean, there's other parameters for the whole rest, but this is just constant, right? The other ones are not being touched. So one can do a bunch of other lines in this diagram. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll show the variational calculations. I mean, there's planes where you have kind of drifting coefficients. I mean, in principle, this should all map to some 2D, 2+0 D StatMech models, right? Because it's resemblant at least of a two-dimensional partition function what you construct that way, but we're not really sure what exactly this maps to. So it should map to something with a Z4 times Z4 most complex. So if someone knows about these kind of drifting transitions, it would still be interesting to see what this maps to. There's other transitions like between Torrey code and double semion where we get like two different critical exponents on both sides of the phase transition, which I'm also not sure where they show up. They probably show up somewhere in a four-state pots. Transition or something like that, or two coupled Ising chains. But yeah, there's quite a zoo of critical exponents. Okay, but let me spend the last 5 minutes to discuss a variational simulation. So the other thing we did was kind of the next step now is to really take a real Hamiltonian and variationally optimize tensors and try to compute, well, the order parameters and the critical exponents in the phase diagram. So if you take a Torrey code with these fields, the phase diagram is known. So there's a topological phase, then there's a trivial phase, but through two different mechanisms, right? Either condensation of electric or magnetic particles. And then there's this first order line, which at some point stops.
What's the understanding of this endpoint?
Sorry?
What's the understanding of the endpoint?
I think it's just an end of a first order line, right? It's
some kind of gapless.
Sorry?
Is it critical?
I don't know. I would have to look at the literature about this point. We didn't study this point particularly. Okay. So what are we doing? So basically what we're doing here is that we say we variationally optimize a tensor. But in the variational optimization, we enforce a Z2 symmetry. So Z is a matrix with a diagonal matrix with entries plus and minus 1 of some dimension, right? Some Brunt dimension. You are doing 4, 2, 4, and 6. So it's kind of a constrained optimization, just like normal variational simulations. But in a subspace where we freeze that symmetry, because once we define that symmetry, we can also define these anionic objects, which we can use to compute order parameters, right? So we can put flux strings, we can put IREPs. And of course, the thing is, I will discuss this maybe at the end very briefly, there's ambiguity in how you define these, and that's a tricky issue. That's something which doesn't show up for conventional order parameters. There's also an ambiguity here, but let me postpone that. So you can compute these things, and well, we can start with this line, for instance. This line can be mapped to the 2 plus 1 Ising model. Yes?
What's the number of parameters that you can optimize?
Well, Bond dimension 6 is the units. I think the physical system has 16 sides. This is blocked, so it should be 16 times 6 over 4 divided by 2. I can't do the math, but it's fairly large still. I mean, the thing is, compared to an unconstrained optimization, you're just reducing the number of parameters by a factor of 2 because you're tossing in a Z2 symmetry, right? So you cut the space, the variational space of the tensor in half, and you're only using one half of that, basically. But I mean, that's what you usually can do. You can go to something maybe on the order of 10, one dimension 10.
So, no, but could you repeat again? What is the anionic order parameter that you're measuring?
So
what is the quantity you're actually computing?
Okay, so what we're computing is we're optimizing these tensors, right?
But I think you
this is a bit related to the ambiguity discussion, which I wanted to do at the end after I show the order parameters. But okay. So what we're doing is basically we're putting such a string of symmetry operators. So first we optimize a tensor, then we put a string of these Zs, of the symmetry operators, and then we measure two things. Either we measure the normalization of that state relative to the separation of the pair, right? Should go to a constant. And we measure the overlap with the ground state. Okay. And this can also be non-zero, right, in a confined condensed space.
So using just exact diagonalization, is that how you... Like,
No. What?
When you say optimize, like you have your variational thing and then you have something else.
Say again?
Well, so then you optimize your variational state and you have the exact state, or like what's that other thing that you optimize?
No, you have a Hamiltonian, and then you try to minimize the energy, right, by variationally minimizing the energy with regard to the respect to the tensor. Which I didn't, but that's standard methods, right? What we add in is that we enforce a symmetry, which is not done.
But which are your parameters in your, so you have some variational parameters, so what?
No. I mean, it's variation in the sense like normal variational tensor network simulations, that you take a tensor, and all entries in the tensor are your variational parameters. Okay. You don't take an ansatz, right? The ansatz is just to take a tensor with whatever, 1,000 parameters or 10,000 parameters, like you would do in DMRG. It's less parameters, but on the other hand, of course, you capture the 2D structures.
So say it again, this is a finite system.
No, it's infinite.
Infinite.
So it's infinite, and we put the same tensor at every side. I mean, otherwise, it doesn't really make sense to measure order parameters if you break translation invariance in a variational ansatz, right? It's not clear how you would do this properly. Of course, if you would measure a physical property, it doesn't matter if your ansatz in the way it's built breaks translation symmetry. But we're not measuring something which has a direct relation to physical properties somehow, right? It's something on the entanglement system. I think it has physical relevance, but it's not a physical observable, right? At least it's not clear if it's a physical observable a priori.
Right.
So one can really measure order parameters for condensation and confinement. So this line is known in some sense to map to the 2 plus 1 Ising model. So this is actually exact. This really maps the condensation order maps to the magnetization of the 2 plus 1 Ising model, which is plotted with the stars here. And you see you basically get exactly the same line. Small dimension doesn't work well, but as soon as you increase your bond dimension, it works very well. So you get the right behavior. We can also measure electric excitations, which don't map to some nice quantity in the 2 plus 1 Ising model. They map to something like the ratio of two partition functions, namely the 2 plus 1 Ising model, and the 2 plus 1 Ising model with a branch cut where you put antiperiodic boundary conditions. I have no idea if this has been considered, so if there's a, it's known what the critical exponent should be. So that's the critical exponent we get, so it's very small. I have no idea what this relates to. If anyone knows about something where a critical exponent like that shows up, I would be very interested, because it's not clear to us if that's something new or it can be related to some known quantity. I think in some way it should be related to something known, right? There's so many duality mappings. that it should link to something, but we don't know to what it links. So maybe it is something which doesn't show up in 2+1 theories in a local fashion. Could also be. And then, of course, we can also move away from that line and still measure these order parameters. And what we see is that indeed this phase transition line has a fixed universality class, so it's 2+1 Ising. With this additional critical exponent, where, again, we don't know how it relates to 2+1 Ising. At least if you try to squeeze it through the mapping, you get this funny branch cut, which is not what you usually consider, I guess. Right. Okay, so I have some plots on these transitions, but I guess I will skip them in the interest of time. I guess I should finish, right? So if you want, you can still ask me, but it turns out that you indeed see what you expect, namely that first you have 2 second-order transitions, then 1 first-order transition, and if you move out, then everything gets fuzzy. In some sense, what is really remarkable is that the method still works out here, because you enforce a symmetry which has nothing to do with the physics, right? Because it's not actually topologically ordered. So in some sense, it's surprising that the symmetry is still being made use of. It kind of becomes fuzzy here, because indeed you get a crossover, and what happens here and what happens here, I mean, these two phases are very different, right? One condenses magnetic particles, one condenses electric particles, but it's still the same phase. So in some sense, there's some kind of crossover, which indeed numerically shows up in the fact that these order parameters become kind of a bit ill-behaved in that regime. But you can also see that the entanglement space starts to get detached from the physical space. That's actually another remarkable thing. The system is not forced to make use of the entanglement space, the symmetry. You could, in principle, write down ansatzes where you completely detach the space in the topological phase, and you still get a topological ansatz. So the fact it works is kind of remarkable. Of course, it works because not using these degrees of freedom and detaching them from the physical world means you're giving up variational parameters. So, of course, it's more favorable to use those. But it could actually also mean that if you push this to a very high bond dimension, it could become subtle again to really get these entanglement symmetries involved. Because it's in some sense, it's not mandatory. But, I mean, you see it works. These things are well defined. OK, let me skip the discussion about how to construct these things in a gauge invariant way. If you want, ask me. Then I will have to admit that I cheated in one of the plots, but the plot is correct. It's just kind of cheated in claiming what we computed. And let me just finish. Thanks a lot for your attention.
All right. Questions well answered.
So I guess one of the important advances, right, is that, I mean, in principle, if you have this variational state, it's very complicated to compute anything, right, because it's a 2D thing, right? So the important advance that allows you to compute these, say, critical exponents is this kind of this double-legged ladder, right, that you've been able to kind of identify. Is that this double-legged ladder, like there in the middle?
Okay, what's the question? I'm not sure I got the question.
I'm just trying to understand, like, the important sort of advance that allows you to compute some of these, say...
I don't think anything has measured these things. I think no one has defined these objects.
This is the advance, right?
I think it's conceptually new to write down these order parameters for anions. Of course, they're related to things people might have measured. But I think in this form, people haven't measured it.
Right, because directly you can't compute anything. It's a 2D PEPS, right? So that's the key.
No, I'm not sure what the meaning of these objects is if you don't think about tensor networks, because there is no entanglement space. So I'm not sure how you would define these objects if you wouldn't think in this picture.
So if I may answer, this is our panel discussion. So I'm still a bit fuzzy the definition of the strings, right? Mm-hmm. Since you're not talking about Hamiltonian, these are not done specific sigma x or sigma z operators acting on Ising variables. So if you say it's a string, what do you actually do in computation? You have this six dimensional bond. So what do you do? You just alter in some arbitrary way the coefficients of the tensor.
Okay, so
such that it preserves the symmetry and you say, well, let's see if that's what happens.
No. Okay, so step one is we do a variational, we have a Hamiltonian, right? And we do a variational optimization of the ground state energy by making an ansatz of an infinite PEPS.
Right? Well, if somebody gave you the optimized PEPS, that's what it is. How would you know?
But in this optimization, we only optimize over tensors with a certain symmetry, right? We enforce that the tensor in the course of the optimization has a certain entanglement symmetry, which is related to the topological order we guess might be there. So basically, you would have to give me that tensor and tell me what that symmetry was.
Okay, so
tell me C2. No, not just C2. You have to tell me the representation, right? You have to tell me the actual symmetry action on the tensor, right? So you give me a sigma z, basically, or a matrix. And then what I can do is I can construct that wave function. And in that wave function, I can build in a magnetic string, so a string of these Cs, which I put on the links before I contract them.
you see that in the regular protocol, signal Z acts on the physical variables, the gauge fields, the loop, and the links. Here I have the six-dimensional object, which is the coefficients of the tensor. How does sigma Z?
It's not sigma Z in that case, right? It would be a diagonal matrix, 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1.
So, right? So it's
some representation of these two. That's what I'm saying, right? You need to have a representation, and then when you build a state, you have a way of putting, say, a pair of magnetic excitations by putting a string of these Z operators, which is some representation of Z2, the one you have been using in your optimization. You can put these strings on the entanglement legs when you contract them, right? So when you contract the legs, you multiply them with Z. And then we're computing things like these overlaps, which I showed and so on, like the asymptotic value.
That's right.
Or the correlation length, which you can also extract at hoc. You don't have to compute
and
many.
Which ones would you show two kind of variables? If you go one slide or two slides back, mm-hmm. you show two plots, where the 2 points is plotted.
Which here?
So the top and the bottom, one called magnetic excitations, yes, called electric excitations. So what is the point here you actually plot?
Okay, so I cheated. That's what I already said, right? So what? How did I cheat? Wait, oh, that's the wrong one, right? That's the only one, yes. Okay, so what we plot here, that's really this measuring this Z string on a single layer.
Taking
overlap with the ground state, like a semi-infinite Z string, and taking the overlap with the ground state, and this could be zero or it could have a finite value. Normalized overlap, right? All of that is normalized. So that's what I plot here. What I actually plot here is I'm using the self-duality of the model, and I'm going along this line. And I'm doing the same thing, but for confinement. So actually, this is a magnetic confinement along this line, but I know it's the same because of the duality of the model.
Which means you have two
pairs. So in that case, I would do the same. I would put the semi-infinite string of the symmetry operation, but I would compute a normalization of that wave function divided by the normalization of the bare wave function. Now, what I would like to do, and what we did in the previous plots, where we built this thing by hand, right? In the previous plots, we had this three-parameter family, right? Where I really built an explicitly controlled family of wave functions. What I would like to do, actually, is not to put a semi-infinite string and compute a normalization, but I would like to put, right? I mean, that's a semi-infinite string. That's what we computed. Either normalization or overlap with a ground state. What I would like to compute there for the electric is to actually put something which is an IREP and do the same calculation, overlap with a ground state or normalization. Now, what is the problem here? The problem is that this is not uniquely defined. A string is uniquely defined, right? You just don't put any non-trivial endpoint. This is not uniquely defined. And so the issue is I get this tensor from a variational optimization. This means there could be more than one variational optimum. And the minimal thing I know is that if I do a gauge transformation of that kind, right, it will cancel out because of the translation invariant ansatz. So any of these could be the outcome of my variational optimization. Now, the point is if I have to put something which anti-commutes with a diagonal symmetry, sigma z, this would be the IREP. Why is that minus one? Well, that's fine. Then this would not commute with that gauge transformation, right? It would not be invariant under the gauge transformation because you would get these mixed terms here. So what we haven't figured out yet is how to define these objects in a gauge invariant way. In some sense, it would be like if I would give you the Ising model, and for different magnetic fields, I would randomly rotate the basis, keeping the Z2 symmetry, right? But rotate in the whatever YZ plane or so, if the symmetry is X. But I would completely randomly rotate in a non-analytic way. Then there's no way you can define an order parameter which would give you any meaningful behavior. Because your order parameter would randomly rotate in the YZ plane as well. And that's somehow the issue here, right? That things potentially don't change analytically unless you find a nice way of gauge fixing. That might be one solution, right? If you find a good way of gauge fixing, that's probably fine. And in the previous thing, the family of wave functions, the point was that, of course, a tensor would change analytically with the parameters. So it's like if in the Ising model, if I would analytically rotate the basis of the Ising model, I could define order parameters and would get the same critical exponents, right? So that's an open question, certainly, how to do this properly. Which is particularly interesting, of course, if, say, you do double semi on it and you want to measure this order parameter for the dion, because then you cannot play the tricks I just played with the duality.
So to EG and then plug.
So for the three order, do they just correspond to some Wilson-like operator which create excitations in this three order?
It's the same intuition, certainly, yes.
Yeah,
I mean, if you have a fixed point, yes, that's basically.
So if I know the Brown state correspond to a specific topological order, I know what kind of string order I should write on measure. But if I have no idea what type of topological order it is, how do I determine what type of string order should I measure?
As I said, you need some initial guess, in the sense that you want to impose some symmetry in the tensors when you optimize the tensors, and the symmetry gives you kind of the most complex phase you can get. But you could get any kind of derived phase, like condensed phase, which starts from there. But yes, but I think that's common to most methods, that it basically should or must have some initial guess of what phases you could potentially have. But you don't have to know the exact phase. But your guess should kind of should include it through some condensation mechanism, so to say.
I have two very related questions. One is about when you're approaching the phase transition between two phases, that in general doesn't have to be two topological phases, but using this method, what constrains how large your bond dimension should be in the following sense. So, for example, if you're in 1 plus 1D CFT, mm-hmm. central charge determines how large bond dimension you need.
Mm-hmm.
And central charge is a universal number, and coincidentally, that's a leading term in the entanglement. S is like
mm-hmm.
C log N.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2 plus 1D, the universal term in the entanglement is a subleading term. It's not an area law, but it's a subleading term
mm-hmm.
at a CFT.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit counterintuitive that the somehow the some constant term in the entanglement may constrain how large the bond dimension needs. Do you have any understanding of, given a, let's take the simplest CFT that you do understand, like this Ising model, 2 plus 1D Ising model, what universal quantity of the CFT constrains the bond dimension?
I don't even know if that's true, right? Maybe there is no universal quantity showing up in the bond dimension.
Sorry.
Maybe there is no universal quantity showing up in the bond dimension, right? If there's, I mean, if there's only an additive correction to the area law, it still obeys the area law, essentially, right?
So
the point is there's always, in some sense, there's always an area law. There's sort of an upper bound, right?
Sure,
at the critical point.
There's a slightly different question, but somewhat related. If I take a gap phase of matter,
mm-hmm.
not for let's say, CFT, let's take some string net model for which we know exactly how to write down the bond dimension, how to write down the MPS. Isn't there some relation between the bond dimension that you need, but the minimal bond dimension you need for the fixed point function, and the topological data of the theory?
Yes.
So at least in that case, there's a relation between the how large your bond dimension is, and probably one of your, I don't know, all of these topological data.
Well, of course, if you do the canonical way of writing it, you will get, I don't know, something like a number of particle types to the 3 or so. But then in many cases, you can compress because the fusion hoops are constrained and
yes,
so on. I'm not sure if there's some one-to-one correspondence.
So after
right?
compression, everything.
Sorry?
After compression.
I don't know if there's a relation after compression. I wouldn't say no, but you know, if you massage things by hand, maybe you find a clever trick to reduce the number of degrees of freedom.
But I think there may have been a misunderstanding. So you're asking about 2 plus 1 CFT.
Right? That was the first question.
That's right, that was the first question, which means you have two gap theories and there's a second other phase transition.
Right, which is what we discussed.
That's right. And in that case, it's known that the entropy law, forget about the law of constant you asked about, has L log L dependence.
No.
Well,
fermionic system. I'm talking about Lorentz. This is a CFT. Fermion is not a CFT. So I'm saying for CFTs, it's well understood what the upscaling is. It's area law minus a constant. And constant is the universal.
Right. But that constant talks about the topological order.
No, no, I'm talking about phases. I think you're confusing two things. There's a constant in topological phases, but there's also a constant in a CFT. For example, in the 2 plus 1 Ising model, there's some fixed number, which is some 0.06 or something. That's the number.
I think you also want to be careful when thinking about these generic things from string net models and zero closure length systems, because the reducency matrix of those systems is so simple that the area law term is just the bond dimension times L.
Right.
And so it sort of, it may seem like that may be where this bond image structure is coming from, not from the subtraction of topological entropy.
That was my, that was trying to lead to that. I think there's a, there is some constraint between the subleading term, at least practical point of view, and the coefficient of area law.
There certainly is in the zero course.
In zero course, I think it, even in people do tensor network, they see, even for critical point, they have seen such things, but no one has made it kind of understanding. But
this is for, so do you necessarily have to impose this symmetry? In principle, couldn't you get the same things by just doing an unconstrained and perhaps?
I think you could try doing an unconstrained optimization and then try to extract the symmetry afterwards. So I talked to Philippe Corbeau recently, and he said they were doing that, and it seemed to work indeed to extract the symmetry afterwards. But I'm not sure how it's trickier, right? I mean, what I understood is that you also the tensor doesn't acquire the symmetry, but you can kind of kick out whatever doesn't have the symmetry, and it won't change the variational ansatz. It could work, but it's an additional complication, and I think you still need to guess what your symmetry is. You want to kind of, well, maybe not. I mean, if it would work perfectly, you have to identify zero blocks in your tensor. So maybe that could give you more flexibility.
Yeah,
but it's not clear that the tensor actually acquires that. There could be non-trivial cancellations. So in that single tensor, you don't see the symmetry, but on a larger scale, it kind of comes back because, you know, you get loops and things cancel along that loop. So I think one would have to do some extensive testing to see if that works. Just be lucky.
That's good. Follow-up, like, I mean, the topological order is usually very fragile if you violate the gauge symmetries of the tensors, right? So, for example, if you would measure topological entanglement and you just have small perturbations of the gauge symmetry, it would basically go to zero. Are you saying that this one is more robust than measuring topological order as an indicator for measuring topological entanglement?
Say again?
But you said that it would work even if you don't fix the gauge symmetry.
That's the information I got from Philippe, so
okay.
I'm not sure how much I can say about that.
No, but it would be interesting if that is more robust than measuring topological entanglement.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Any more standing questions, comments? If not, let's thank Norbert again.